Ah, the start of the week and loads on the radio, from an emotional interview with rugby pundit Fred Pope to a word on Hiberno English and row, row, row your boat in the Oxford and Cambridge boat race. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Just to make it very clear, we don't want to skip the queue. We want to be prioritised after these groups are done, because we are unable to keep social distance from the children that we care for who aren't wearing masks.
Flag waving and nationalism is something that can be good but also can be dangerous. That for me was, we had to kind of let go a little bit of our identities in order to make peace with our neighbours.
It's a fierce, tough sport. Are you sore today?
Yeah, I'm in bits.
And we'll start here. After all those chocolate eggs on Sunday, here comes the guilt. And no, it's not just the calories, it's the packaging. Thousands of tons of waste is generated over Easter. And Seamus Clancy is the CEO of Repack, and he was talking to Ordie Carville in the morning.
Yeah, I suppose after Christmas, Easter is the second biggest time of the year in terms of generating waste, and packaging waste in particular. Compound that with COVID and everybody staying at home, and then the volume of Easter eggs that are consumed over Easter, we're expecting roughly the generation of about 49,000 tonnes of packaging waste over the Easter period. That's the equivalent of filling the empty Aviva Stadium today. I suppose it's a reflection as well of the whole buying pattern, eating pattern and drinking habits of consumers in Ireland. They have changed significantly as well because of COVID. We're seeing a huge increase, really, right across the board, 10% year on year already. And I suppose over the Easter period, we see, you know, our survey shows you like 79% of people are still going to celebrate Easter, 50% of those with family. And I suppose what always amazes me is that, you know, 57% of people said they'll buy at least 6 Easter eggs. So I don't know how many you bought, Audrey, but some people even buy 10 or more.
Yeah, well, so I didn't buy 10 or more now. I think I bought 2.
But you obviously bought 6 or more, maybe. So, but I think what's really encouraging as well, though, is producers have bought into what's needed as well because of consumer demand and legislation. So we are seeing that, you know, nearly everything in packaging on Easter eggs now is recyclable.
Yeah. Is most of it recyclable?
Yes, most of it is now. You're talking about, particularly, there's a huge amount of cardboard in boxes now. A lot of the plastic has been reduced, and even the plastic that's used is recyclable now in the main. And then all the foil is also, once you crunch it up and put it in your bin, and just, I suppose, we're saying to people all over the country, is to make sure what you put in your recycling bin is clean, dry and loose.
So is that okay then, Seamus? As long as it's recyclable, does it matter how much packaging there is?
Oh, it does, of course. We have to reduce. You're using resources from all over the world, and that's not sustainable. You know, the consumption levels that we're doing, like in our country, is high. Same throughout Europe, any of the first world countries, if I put it that way. We are consuming too much. And with population growth, we actually have to look to reduce and to recycle more and to keep it within a circular economy. Good example, I suppose, you take glass for last year. Like, we're probably number one in Europe now in terms of glass. We recycled 87% of it. But last year alone, glass increased by 14%, and that's really a reflection of consumer behaviour as well in terms of our drinking habits at home.
Yeah.
Overall, packaging has remained fairly stable because it's moved from the hospitality sector into the home, which is very tough in the hospitality sector. But in the main, Irish people have really embraced recycling. We want people to encourage them to do more of that.
Seamus Clancy from Repack, from Morning Ireland with Audrey Carville. And on the Marty Morrissey Show, Patrick Keelty was talking about finding the funny in the dark times. And we'll start with his borderline postcard from the edge of the union from the BBC.
I think that there's been so much misunderstanding, and there's been, you know, the place that you're from, whenever the place that you're from, you're constantly hearing on the news that this is a problem. And in your head, you realise that you're not the problem and people there aren't the problem. But what is happening to the place you call home is a problem. I wanted to write something about that. And there was, for a long time, that when you grow up in a GAA house and you grow up in County Down and you believe that, you know, you are Irish, yet you are living in the UK. And so there is that sort of bipolar personality that an identity that people have when they're growing up in County Down at that time. And I originally wanted to go and do a show on the actual land border and take a little theatre, you know, somewhere in Newry and talk about what it was like growing up there at the time. And then Boris Johnson, in his infinite wisdom, gave me the gift that the border actually moved. And so I didn't have to drive 20 miles from Dundrum to Newry to go to the border. The border suddenly arrived on the Irish Sea, just overlooking the house in Dundrum, County Down. So I wanted people to know that maybe we aren't the problem. And maybe if you listen to what we've been through, I think flag waving and nationalism is something that can be good, but also can be dangerous. And whenever you grow up somewhere where you've got two identities and two nationalities living tooth and jowl, and that for me was we had to kind of let go a little bit of our identities in order to make peace with our neighbours. And to see now that identity has been waved around and nationalism has been waved around as a good thing, I just wanted to sort of, you know, put a little, you know, niche on the post to say, be careful. So that's really what it was about.
Well, Paddy Keelty, I think it's superb, but this is the bit that I particularly liked.
When peace finally arrived here in Northern Ireland, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. The Good Friday Agreement meant that for the first time in 100 years, we didn't have to choose one identity. We could be British, Irish, both, or neither. We were non-binary before the term even existed. In Northern Ireland, you could at last be whatever you wanted to be, apart from gay and hoping to get married. We let all the killers out of jail. And as a reward for that, some of those killers went into government and ran the country. Hang on, that can't be right, can it? Some people were outraged, purely on principle. But people with principles don't make peace. Tony Blair and Bill Clinton make peace. Oh, and a woman called Mo, who told Ian Paisley to piss off, threatened to headbutt Gerry Adams, called Martin McGuinness babe, and whose favourite joke was, what do toilets, birthdays and clitorises have in common? Men miss them. And I miss her. We all had to give ground, suck it up, compromise. The Queen shook hands with Martin McGuinness, which horrified some people. I can't believe he's shaking her hand after all she's done. Some saw it the other way. Isn't it awful that the Queen has to meet someone so awful? Personally, I think with all the money the Queen has, she should have to meet someone awful every week. And now Boris Johnson is Prime Minister, she does.
And joking aside, Paddy is concerned about the current situation in Northern Ireland.
I think it is worrying. I think one of the things that the Good Friday Agreement did was if you were a nationalist north of the border, you were basically told that your life could be as Irish as you wanted to be. And so everybody could have their Irish passport. The idea of crossing the border, you weren't really crossing the border because the border didn't exist. And so physically, people's lives became as Irish as they wanted them to be. There was no impediment to it. And I think if you look at what's happening to unionists at the moment, that idea of what do you mean I can't take, like the weird, there's weird stuff in it, you know, like you apparently there's a lot of very dangerous stuff you're not allowed to bring into Northern Ireland now, like sausages and pot plants, Marty, you know, it's very, very strange. So I think that whenever you suddenly start changing people's lives without actually asking them, you're going down the wrong road. Yet at the same time, what's the options? I mean, you have a 300-mile land border in Ireland with 300 crossings. You have three ports in Northern Ireland and two airports. I mean, where do you think you're going to do the checks? And unfortunately, the problem is that nothing good is going to come from it. I mean, if you had to put the checks, you know, on the border, on the island itself, that would have been a disaster. This isn't much better. Mm. And I think people on the ground are, they're looking back in a way that they haven't looked back before, in that idea of, could things get worse? You know, we were always taught after the Good Friday Agreement, things are going to get better, your lives are going to get better, everything's going to move forward. And while, you know, leadership in the North is very constipated at best for in terms of moving forward, the people moved forward. So it's a worrying time.
You mentioned Good Friday, and what I find amazing is the passage of time, Paddy. It's 23 years old now. And going back to that time, to the Good Friday, you voted, I know, in favour of it, even though it meant that the men who had murdered your father would be released. That must have been tough.
For me, all of these things are, if you look at what the price for peace is, if you look at, if you want to be the generation that makes the change in your own lifetime, then you're going to have to suck stuff up. It wasn't just me that was sucking stuff up. There was a whole generation of people up there that knew people that were lost or had lost someone. And ultimately, if you want the future for the next generation to be better, then you have to take difficult decisions. For me and for a lot of people, there's that idea of, you know, what is the price of peace? And I always say the price of peace is about 5 miles further up the road than you think you can actually go. I think what is interesting is that when people are actually prepared to make the progress and take the decisions that make the pips squeak at the time, and then now see people who kind of don't really understand what people went through, making decisions which affect their lives, that's when it becomes a bit more difficult.
Absolutely. You know, I'm just thinking back to that time, you know, when you were growing up, Belfast wasn't exactly a hotbed of political comedy. So who were your role models?
It's funny, actually, because when you're from Dundrum County down, even just going to Belfast, that was the big smoke. Mm. And so for me, my role models at the time, you were listening to Billy Connolly tapes in the car with your dad. I remember there was a brilliant moment where, you know, you're sitting with your dad and you're 12 and he's 40 and you're both listening to Billy Connolly and he's going through the whole walking into the North Sea and the water licking your underside of your butt. I can't actually, you know, say that on air, but the fact that he's looking at me and I'm looking at him,
yeah,
and the two of us are laughing and Billy's swearing and no one cares. So there was that brilliant thing that Billy Connolly used to say, which was, you can say whatever you like, as long as you sort of step over the line, smile, and then step back. And I think that that was something that stuck with me, which was, if you want to bring something to the line, people have to know that's a joke and you step over and you step back. Mm. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong, but it's a good note to have.
And Paddy spoke about moving to LA with his wife, Kat Deely, and their children.
I think what was interesting about when you're Irish and you go to America, the welcome that you have, you know, you're actually part of the fabric. You are, you know, there's so many Irish Americans, there's so many Jewish Americans, there's so many, the diaspora when they go to America. So it was a very easy place. I mean, I had family in California. I'd been going to Los Angeles from when I was 18. You know, my grandmother spent most of her life in California. My dad's sister lived over there. My dad's brother was in Washington, D.C.
You had family connections.
Yeah. So, you know, that was great. I think in terms of family and what you want to do, you know, whenever you realize that grandparents aren't getting any younger and kids are starting school age and the sun's shining in Beverly Hills and you think you're probably not going to come home. And then you realise, well, what's important in life? And it's the fact that, you know, are they going to see those grandchildren? Is there going to be a relationship? Are they going to know their cousins? And we timed it perfectly, Marty. I mean, you know, we decided to come home at the start of last year, at the start of 2020, because we wanted to see family and we wanted them to go to, you know, school here. And for the last year, they've seen nobody and we've been teaching them ourselves. So the secret of comedy is timing, Marty, apparently.
So how's the homeschooling going? What's dad like as a teacher of maths?
You always sneak back into, it's that thing that, you know, whenever you've been taught by the, you know, the Christian brothers, the military wing of the Catholic Church yourself, you know, you realise the mistakes that you don't want to make. And it's that thing of, just basic stuff. I mean, our eldest fella, he's only five.
Yeah.
And even just the alphabet, they pronounce it differently.
Really?
They have a thing called phonics now. You're looking at something and you're saying, you know, that's P. And they're going, no, Dada, that's P. That's P.
Yeah.
And so when you can't help a five-year-old with his own...
So you're learning from him, really.
Never as glad to see a child walk up the path and head back to school in my life. And I think neither was he. He was going, see you, Dada.
Be good.
Yeah, be good. Learn how to pronounce Dada. Yeah. Dada.
And Paddy, I mean, you've been a stand-up comedian, a huge success. Now you're appearing in a movie and a film, as they say in various shows. What would you like to be doing in 5 years' time?
I would like to be leading the GAA, Marty.
Good.
And I would like the rule change that all kickouts have to pass the 50. To stop the blanket defence. That's my ambition in life.
Like a true GA man.
My ambition in life is to do away with puke football. Is there any chance?
Not looking good at the moment, Steady. But we're working on it, absolutely. Are you glad to be home? Are you glad to be back? Or did you, I mean, what will you miss most about America?
You know, I think one of the things about Americans is that sometimes what we do is we give an entire nation a trait of a single person. I remember coming home and people saying to me, you know, geez, how do you stick it over there with your man Trump? He's just your typical stupid yank. Like, and so a whole nation is just, you know, a stupid yank. And you're sitting there thinking, I mean, Donald Trump is like a man in his 70s. You know, he's made a few quid in construction. He thinks white people are superior and he cheats at golf. I mean, there's one of those guys in every pub in Ireland. So the idea of that you're going over there to some type of intellectually bereft place, I was stimulated by what was going on over there. Coming back here, what I love now is still having the house in Dundrum, County Down, to actually get back there. Kat used to say to me all the time, whenever we would go down to the beach and you'd be at Santa Monica and you'd be looking at the Santa Monica Mountains, and I would say to her, I know, but I mean, it's not the beach at Newcastle, is it really? Like, I mean, yeah. The more Sleep Donard there, Sleep Donard knocks that into a cocked hat, doesn't it?
And I'm sure Kat would appreciate that as well.
Oh, she did, surely, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she did. She was saying, when can we leave Malibu and get back to Mourne?
Patrick Keelty from The Marty Morrissey Show. Now, an Irish rower was one of the winning teams in the Oxford and Cambridge annual boat race. Caoimhe Dempsey from County Wicklow spoke to Gavin Jennings on the News at One.
Like probably a lot of people in Ireland, I'd never really heard of rowing until I went to university. I went to Trinity for my undergrad and started rowing there. Had never done it before. And then, yeah, I guess the passion for the sport kind of just grew from there. I spent 4 years rowing for Trinity and did some rowing for Ireland while I was there. Went to the U23 European Championships and the Home International Regatta. And then a couple of the rowers that I was being coached by and then had on the team had been to Cambridge or were going over to Cambridge. So it kind of spurred my interest into, I guess, following in their footsteps and having a crack at the boat race. And so, yeah, I mean, like, it's a great place to be for studying, and then for rowing, it's just amazing. So yeah, that's led me over to here, and I did a master's here last year, and I'm doing a PhD now, and the love for the sport is still building.
What's training been like as a team during all the restrictions?
Yeah, it's been really difficult, you know, because with the lockdowns, we've been having to, you know, stop rowing on the water, and we've been coming training at home alone. So that's doing things like on the rowing machine in our gardens, doing weights in our gardens, that kind of thing. And that's obviously been completely different to normal and really difficult, because, you know, the actual on the water rowing is the interesting part, not all the stuff on land. So yeah, it's been an added challenge for sure, but it's been lovely to be able to race.
Am I right to say that you come from a pretty sporty family?
Yes, yep, I am. Yeah, I've got some good sporting role models, female role models. My mother, she was a hill runner and she was on the Irish hill running team and adventure racing team. So running up and down mountains and that kind of thing, crazy stuff.
So what's next in your sporting career?
Well, I've got another 2 years here in Cambridge. So in terms of rowing, it's kind of the best place for me to be right now, because, you know, for me to kind of just see how far I can push myself and the standard that I can get to myself to within the sport, being in this program, like such a high performance program like the Cambridge team is exactly the kind of place that I can do that. So yeah, that's going to be me.
It's a fierce, tough sport. Are you sore today?
Yeah, I'm in bits.
Caoimhe Dempsey on the News at One with Gavin Jennings. And in the afternoon, Colm O'Regan wanted a word about how Irish people speak English in the company of comedians Sharon Mannion and Paul Tylak. His special guest was Dr. Stephen Lutek from the Department of Linguistics at UCD. And Stephen was explaining what a sociolinguist is.
Well, a sociolinguist takes language and tries to find why people say certain things a certain way. We look at social factors, so it could be your age, your gender, the place where you live. And these are some of the reasons why you do certain things. For the most part, you want to sound like other people. You want to be liked. It's a human nature thing. But one of the ways you can do that is by sounding like other people or sounding very different from other people.
Stephen, couldn't let you go on further out mentioning that you sound like you might have arrived here from another place. Where are you from?
My mother is from Leitrim. I'm originally from Boston.
Very good. So you're coming over here, taking our language and telling us why we say the way we say it. Hiberno-English, where does it come from, or what is it? How would you define it?
The easiest way to look at it is the English language as experienced by Irish people. So there's a number of different inputs we have, the Irish language being a huge one, but also older versions of English as well that stay, we call them retention features of the language.
Stephen, how important is it to us that we have this vernacular? Is it good for our mental health to still retain it? Or is it just an affectation that we're sort of in love with?
I think it's wonderful that a small country that always punches above its weight in so many different areas is proud of itself, is displaying some pride. I know it's always the same things over and over again, but it's a real sign of sort of taking agency over the language. The language that was, in fairness, foisted upon the Irish people, and taking control of it and saying, you know what, actually, we can do a pretty good job with this language. Win Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes all over the place. And that's sort of the long tail of colonialism. It's coming back to sting. The places where it came from.
I hadn't expected to want to go out and sing the Wolf Tones after, but now I'm ready.
Yeah,
I'm ready to roll. So we are proud of our Hiberno-English, but also we are snobbish about which bits of it sometimes that we see as being part of it. We love the words in lists, but sometimes official Ireland doesn't like the pronunciation. Now, I've been guilty of that sneering in the past, but I'm trying to see the beauty in it, especially the R's we add into words. So now we go live to the latest press conference from Feket, where there is concern about the R number.
Good afternoon to you all. I know you will have some concerns about the R number.
What is the current position?
Yes, well, the R number has gone up significantly.
Can you give examples?
Yes, as you know, we have been aware of Chicago and Chapel Lizard for some time.
Do we have any idea why?
No, it's puzzling because both Chapel Lizard and Chicago are written in so many places, in print. I mean, there's really no excuse. In the Cork incident, a patient watched 10 hours of the Netflix Michael Jordan documentary and still said he was a fan of the Chicago Bulls. Here in Dublin, we had a report from someone from Chapel Lizard saying that they lived in Chapel Lizard all their life across from the post office, even though the post office has the word Chapel Lizard written on it.
Should we be concerned about reports of new variants?
We can't comment on those.
We are hearing about Daleks being heard in a number of counties, despite it being much easier to say Daleks.
And these are reports from who?
No, not him. A different doctor.
Well, we can't comment on individual cases. OK, that'll be all. If there's no further questions, have a good weekend, everyone, and I'll see you afterwards for a lager.
What? Are you OK?
I said I'll see you afterwards for a lager. Oh, dear. Yeah, it looks like I'm going to have to self-isolate for a while.
From Colm O'Regan, once a word. And in the morning, the emotional interview Marty Morrissey had with rugby pundit and author Brent Pope. It's been a tough year for Brent.
It's been a hellish year. It really, really has. I've ended up in hospital 3 or 4 times for varying things, undergoing, my arms look like pin cushions over that many needles in them. Yeah, I'm still undergoing testing for a lot of things, and unfortunately, some of them could be serious, you know. So I'm not the same Brent Pope I was 12 months ago, and my life has changed forever. And it's not just COVID, it's going through this present health condition, which I'm yet to get answers about. I don't know whether those answers are going to be good or they're not. And, you know, people can notice it in my personality more than anything. I've been in waiting rooms for the last 10 months, waiting for that door to open to look at the doctor and say, look, okay, is it good news or is it not so good news or is it bad news? And it's an awful place to be. It's an awfully scary, lonely place to be. Now, the doctors and nurses and that have been brilliant, but it grinds you down, you know, 10 months grinds you down.
If I may, Brent, what are your symptoms and has there been a diagnosis yet?
No, there's been quite a few diagnoses along the way. I've ended up in the hospital for ulcers and bleeding ulcers and then various stages of liver problems. I've got other symptoms now that, you know, I just got news today they'll have to go back. I had an endoscope last weekend and then they just said, look, something's come up on that, so we're going to have to go in and have another look at that. It's as if my immune system is packed in. It's as if this is a systematic attack. It's not just in one place, it's in a number of places. It's just like at every turn I get a... I consider my health at the moment to be like one of those circus things where the whatever puts its head up and then it gets a bang on the head. So I'm really wanting some good news at some stage, because for the last 10 months I haven't had really anything to be able to hang my hat on without having to be further investigated. So it's like ticking things off the box and saying, well, look, we don't think it's that. That's good news. And then we move on. There's something going on and hopefully we'll get to the bottom of it, fingers crossed, you know, and I can start to be well again.
You're a private man. You didn't publicise this, that you weren't well, until now, really.
No, because I am. And I am because I know people have got their own problems, and I have friends have been great and looked after me when I've had to go into hospital. They've packed up bags for me and that. But it's been hard not being able to visit people, or it's been hard having to talk to my brother or something at home or whatever and get advice. But I mean, you know, everybody needs to learn from this COVID and learn that, you know, life is precious, and to make that call to that person that's going through stuff, or to call into that person that's lonely, or to make more of an effort. And that's when I say that, you know, that things have changed for me and they should be changed for everybody. Yeah. Everybody should lead kinder lives, less materialistic. Yeah. Don't worry about things that you may not have, you know. Yeah. And when you're facing an illness, a lot of people are, it's support and love that you crave.
And Marty asked Brent about living in Ireland and not being able to get back to New Zealand.
I think what kept me here, first of all, was kind of, I suppose, the support and kind of love I had when I came over here, because I came over here in difficult circumstances. And this is the one thing that people don't realise, because it's wrapped around my mental health. Yeah. People say, why did you come to Ireland in the first place? Because I probably gave up a career with the All Blacks at that stage. I was asked to come back that year to trial again for the All Blacks. But I left New Zealand a kind of a scared man in a lot of respects about my mental health. And I came over here just to get away, because I didn't feel that I could open up to anybody in New Zealand, because, you know, you'd be judged as a big, strong, stereotypical rugby player, and I couldn't go to anybody for help. You know, I went to numerous doctors or whatever and would say, look, there's something wrong with me in dealing with certain situations. And they would just say, well, look, you know, that can't be right, because, you know, aren't you bench pressing this, or aren't you player of the match last week? Nothing to do with rugby. So I needed a new environment, Martin, and that's when suddenly two offers sort of came on the table, which was one to go and play for St Mary's in Dublin, and I didn't know what to expect. But I think after the first season, you know, when I got the calls to go back, and I said no, I was enjoying the company and I was enjoying the anonymity, if you know what I mean. Because, yeah, you know, like I'd always been front and centre most of my sporting career. I've always been in front of the media. So then I kind of never went back. I tried to go back the following season and play in New Zealand for another couple of months, but my heart wasn't in it. My heart was in Ireland at that stage because I had friends there. I so enjoyed the lifestyle that was direct, because it wasn't like, I equate it to more being like a GAA lifestyle in New Zealand. Those early days of sort of rugby was, you know, training all the time, you know, going easy on the drink, and there wasn't too much partying, only after matches or something like that. But I came over here, it was completely different. It was like, wow, you know, you finished the match and off we went down to Leeson Street and met all the other players coming in from all the other teams. And they were great days, mate. Mm. And I loved that part of the lifestyle because I'd never had that. So from 29 onwards, that was part of my life.
Yeah.
So then I stayed on, and then only I got into TV was a kind of a fluke. And it was Bill O'Hurley that had a talk to me late after the first show and said, Brent, we'd love you to stay for the whole World Cup.
I suppose the love affair between the people of Ireland and you began when you started appearing on television and that relationship you had with George Hook. And I'm glad, even when I mentioned that, it brings back a great smile to that Brent Pulp face. But they were great days, and you had great clashes with Mr. Hook.
They were, you know, and people always ask me, were they scripted or whatever? And you know yourself, George and I were about some degree of knowledge, but also some degree of just the regular punter sitting up on a bar stool somewhere in a rugby club in Limerick or Cork or whatever and saying, hold on, you admit it, you're all saying that so-and-so had a great game. I think he's useless, you know. Now, George was more apt to say that than I was. I was sort of good cop, bad cop, and it followed, the Giles and Dunphy, which had been so successful and remained so successful. And I used to always say it, look, I don't know anything about football, but I said, you know, Eamon Dunphy's saying someone is useless, then I presume he's useless, you know. And that was what I wanted to bring to rugby. And we always had the sensible options then, the Conor O'Shea's, the Shane Horgan's, the Rona Gar, all these people that had knowledge of the real game. When I think about the first panel I was on, George didn't come along till about 5 years later, thank God, you know, because, you know, and it was just such a pleasure to get to meet. Here's a great memory for me, is meeting Irish players that I would have revered back in New Zealand, getting up with my father in my pyjamas and watching the old Five Nations, Bill McLaren commentating or whatever, drizzling rain, and seeing players like Willie John McBride or Mike Gibson was a favourite, or Barry John, if that from Wales and that, and getting an opportunity for me to meet those people. But George and I, it was a double act, and people liked it. You know, and I mean, it was never rehearsed. Sometimes I feel like leaning over and belting George. Yeah, absolutely. And it nearly came to that on a couple of occasions.
And Marty asked Brent why he never married.
And this is probably another regret in my life. And people say, oh, well, you know, you had choices. And yes, I did have choices. And all the people that I've relationships with have been wonderful, lovely women. And yeah, it's a regret. I think that's all tied up in my mental health too, Marty, in a sense. I just, when somebody got too close to me in my life, I fended them away. And that was a self-protection mechanism of not being hurt. And I know people say that all the time on these shows, but that genuinely was it for me, because I don't know. I'd always kept people at a kind of a distance, you know. I was still loving and caring in my own way, but if people became too close to me, it wasn't anything to do with commitment, because I wasn't committed long-term relationships. It wasn't like I was flitting in and out of relationships. It definitely wasn't a case of, did the right person never come along? No, that wasn't the case at all. It was to do with the fact that when it became close and came to decision-making processes, I just found that very, very difficult. Mm. So it wasn't that I wasn't committed. It was just that I couldn't give all of me. You know, and then that rolls over into self-sabotage, because I've been doing that all my life, Marty, you know. It doesn't matter what I've been in, whether it's been in rugby, whether it's been in life, whether it's been in relationships, whether it's been anything like that. I've been a self-sabotager, and I've been responsible for my own downfall in that respect. And in the lonely times or the dark times or whatever, that I think, yeah, I've got to put my hand up and say, you know, I've also let a lot of this happen, you know, myself. And I could have made choices. It's, you know, sliding doors or whatever. Could I have stayed in New Zealand and been married and had the two kids and had that lifestyle and played for the All Blacks and, yes, I could have, and that could have been a lifestyle for me. You know, then again, I've come over to Ireland and I've made my life over here, and I've had wonderful relationships and met wonderful people along the way, and that's life too. You know, it is about choices you make along the road, and you know that more than anyone. From a sporting point of view, you can be in the right place at the right time and be in the right place at the wrong time, and that's been my life. You know, if this makes sense, sometimes I just find it easier at my age to be alone.
You really are talking to me here with your heart and your soul exposed, which I really, really appreciate. And if there was, an ability to reverse decisions and go back in time, would you do anything differently?
Yeah, what would I tell my young self? It would be to enjoy life more, Marty, and also to look after my mental health, because I couldn't in the early days and even into my teenage years, I couldn't seem to enjoy the moment. I couldn't seem to enjoy the occasion. I couldn't seem to enjoy relationships and all these things. You know, and it's also about saying to the young people in the country, or not even young people out there that are going through tough periods with their mental health or whatever is, you know, please get help and please get your life back on track, you know, because it was too many years wasted for me, Marty, too many years wasted, you know, being overly anxious, being, you know, worried, being what the future would unfold. The future will unfold how the future unfolds, you know, and just to let go of that sometimes and say, you know, look, hey, you're okay. That's what I would have liked to have said myself. As far as life decisions go, yeah, regrets of probably not having a family of my own, or not being married, or not spending more time taking the kids back to New Zealand. And, you know, I have these visions of what this perfect life looks like for me. And growing up, it was probably boarding a plane with two grandkids or something with their little Irish jumpers on, and, you know, sending them out for a New Zealand summer and that, you know, to surf that would have been beautiful, and also beautiful for my mum and dad. So I feel a bit selfish in the sense that I never gave them grandchildren.
I know it is.
So, Marty, I don't want this to be downbeat, but it's my story and it's my life. I have loved my life in Ireland and will continue to do so. Yeah. I just want people to live fulfilled, wonderful, happy, fun-filled lives, you know, including myself. Why not?
Absolutely. So how are you coping with the public versus the private side of things?
I suppose I'm tired of being the Brent Pope in a sense that everybody expects at this time. It's grinding and it's difficult. And for anybody out there going through, you know, long-term health problems or something like that, sometimes it just grinds you down. And like them, I have a tendency, I presume, to go introverted, because then I start saying, I'm not going to reach out to people. You know, they've got their own worries.
Yeah.
You know, you don't talk to friends as much as you should.
Yeah.
I don't get on the phone. I think, you know, look, they're going through COVID. They're going through all these other problems. They don't want to hear about my various procedures or whatever like that, or testing or whatever. And I should let people in more. You know, it's beautiful to think there's people out there that'll listen to this and, you know, yeah, sorry. Yeah, we'll care for me. You know, it's
you okay?
It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time. I found it really, really hard. And, you know, sometimes you can't keep a brave face. You know, when it's pouring down on top of you, I get caught up in the emotion of it, but.
You okay, Brent?
No, it's fine. You know, it's just you know, one step in front of the other. You know, can't somebody give me some bloody good news for once? And people will ask me on the street about the rugby and that, and I feel like turning around to them and saying, hey, no disrespect, but the rugby is the last thing on my mind at the moment. Yeah. You know, at the moment. Now, you know, fingers crossed that I'll be back to that place. But I wasn't lying earlier when I said my life has changed. Now, hopefully it's changed for the better, and hopefully I'll get better health.
Brent Pope from The Marty Morrissey Show. And on Morning Ireland, SNA Linda was talking about her hands-on work in the classroom during the pandemic.
children from the age of 3 to 6, predominantly in my class, which is an ASD classroom for early intervention. So it's hand-holding, it's nappy changing, it is face-to-face with these children, 6 children in total with no mask wearing. We have no ability to social distance. We are bringing them to OT, we're bringing them to the sensory room, and we're dealing with challenging behaviours on a daily basis, which at times SNAs across the country may experience being bit by a pupil. And that's the reality on the ground, and that's why we are asking to be vaccinated, to protect us and to protect the children that we work for.
And how did you feel when you heard that SNAs would no longer be a priority in the vaccine rollout programme?
Yeah, I suppose I speak on myself and behalf of SNAs. It was a smack in the face as opposed to what we were told in February. So when we reopened schools in February, it was with an understanding that SNAs would be vaccinated in the first 30% of the cohort after vulnerable and elderly. And I suppose, just to make it very clear, we don't want to skip the queue. We want to be prioritised after these groups are done, because we are unable to keep social distance from the children that we care for who aren't wearing masks. And the only, I suppose, the only measure that we have is to keep windows open and to wear masks ourselves, which simply isn't good enough. It's what we had in September and it's what we had in December, and nothing has changed since. And I suppose what angered us more was seeing what happened in the Beacon, and if they can get vaccines, well, they can get vaccines for SNAs and education staff and guards and those who need it. Because as Micheál Martin told us, we wore the front line going back to school, and it's very evident that at the moment they don't see us like that, and that's why the vaccine list changed. And it was it's out of sheer frustration that SNAs are having to take themselves to campaign to be vaccinated as a priority.
SNA Linda for Morning Ireland. And in the morning, actor Cary Crowley was telling Marty Morrissey about being in RTE's big suspense drama Smother.
Yeah, it's great, because sometimes you get involved in something and it could be slated. It could be, you know, totally slammed. But this one has had a very good reaction. And even stuff like, you know yourself, if something goes well, you get the texts.
You do, yeah.
You get the emails. Yeah. Because this is a thriller and it's a noir, it just has another layer. Mm. And it's really interesting, and like, it's a privilege to be part of it in whatever capacity. It's just, and it was a really nice bunch of people. It is a really nice bunch of people. So we had Party Central in Lahinch filming it for the first 2 months until Sea came along, and we had to evacuate and just all head off home, and we didn't know if we'd even get it finished.
Can you imagine a local lad like me, Cary? Because this is, I suppose, why I absolutely love Smother as well. Okay, I know you and I know a few others, but it's filmed in my neck of the woods, and I'm watching it and say, oh, that's that road out to Moy, and that's that road out to Spanish, there's Spanish Point, there's Liscannor. It's a fantastic ad for West Clare and indeed for Lahinch. But filming throughout 2020 must have been rather difficult and strange for you.
It was the weirdest of times, like, because literally the first few months was Party Central. We were so delighted to be in Lahinch. It was a great place to be, like Ennistymon and Liscannor, and the swimming and the eating out and the pubs and Frawley's, and you'd be in there kicking your heels up, you know, with somebody playing trad music. Like, there were so many things that were beautiful about it. Mm. And then to have to go away and not to know that we would return. And it has just become, like, for all of us working in the business, it's become imperative to keep it going. So we might be tested twice a week, every week for a while. And you just get so used to it. It's almost like brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
They put the thing down your throat, then they put it up your nose, and you walk away and you hope that in 24 hours or 48 hours, the result will come back negative. And like, because you're working in a bubble as such. So like, when we went back after the summer, when we were able to go back to start filming again, we were literally our own bubble. Yeah. And everybody from the cast and crew stayed in the one place. We all stayed in the hotel. We had our catering van for breakfast, for lunch. And then we all stayed and ate in the hotel. We couldn't go anywhere else. Because nothing else was open. You could get takeaways and bring them home, bring them back to the hotel. But it was really very much about stay within our bubble. And then we're all doing everything we can do to make it happen.
And how long were you in that bubble for?
A few months again when we went back, so maybe just 2 months, maybe a little bit longer. But there were a few of us that were double jobbing at the time, which is makes it even worse. It's better for the actor, like you're delighted because, you know, you've different projects to focus on. But it means that you're doubly tested because you're moving from one back to another, back to the first, back to the second. And in between, you're constantly tested and retested. For me, it was really interesting to see what the industry could do and how determined people were to make it work and to let the work happen. And it's kind of vital. It's a huge industry in Ireland. But this family, the Smother family, is just a very fine group of people. So, yeah, it has been amazing. And we're beside the sea.
Yes. And I know you. You see, you love the sea. You're an all-year-round swimmer, which has become kind of the sexy thing to do, is to be in the sea 12 months of the year.
I know, it's funny. That's what COVID did. And those of us who were doing it anyway, it just became really funny to see gangs of people coming to the sea, to what we considered our sea. But then a friend of mine said one day, because I was having trippers, I wish they'd all buzz off. And she said, listen, if they're bringing happiness home, that's one really positive thing out of COVID. And I thought she was dead right, because all those people who are coming in their gangs to the sea are going home with that same sense of elation that I would have always had coming out of the water, whether it's the sea or a lake or whatever. There's just some, it does something to your system. So if all those people are going home happier, isn't that brilliant?
And acting isn't the only string to Carrie's bow. So Marty took her back to 1997.
Dublin for the 1997 Eurovision Song Contest. I'm Carrie Crowley.
And I'm Ronan Keating, and this is the 42nd stage.
You haven't changed a bit, Carrie Crowley. You sound as gorgeous as ever.
Show is stop. Do you know what? We were just talking about Waterford, but when the night before the Eurovision, we had the dress rehearsal, and a busload of my friends came up from Waterford, and they all spruced up, and they arrived up from Ali McLaughlin's pub, that was kind of our local. So they all got on the bus and they all travelled up to the dress rehearsal, which was just so gorgeous. And then the night it was on, they all gathered in Ali's, again, dressed in tuxes and gowns and stuff. And like Ali's would be a real old man's bar. That was the kind of bar it was, but we just adored it. It was a great place for music and for singing. But anyway, yeah, they all gathered and watched.
And you know, anyway. And Carrie, when you look back, I mean, after the Eurovision, Carrie Crowley was absolutely everywhere. And I mean, that awful phrase overexposed comes to mind. Did that bother you? That huge overwhelm, it was like a tsunami.
You see, at the time, and I would have said this before, but I genuinely was an accidental tourist. I had no intention of ever working in television. And I applied for a job on the Morbegs as a voiceover person, but ended up acting in it. And that then led to Echo Island, which led to. But it was never the place I planned to be. And anytime somebody said, will you try this? I would just kind of go, yeah. Like looking back very naively and stupidly, I should have said, don't think that's me. Don't think that's my thing. And I was much more a radio person anyway. But the whole reason that I had kind of left teaching in the first place was because I wanted to act. And then it took me like all those years going through all the different little alleyways, singing, radio, television, to finally get back to acting again, full time, to give it, kind of to take the chance on it. And I'm so pleased that I did, you know. But anyway, so yes, I was, as somebody once said, I was on everything except the Angelus.
Carrie Crowley from The Marty Morrissey Show. And on Colm O'Regan Wants a Word on the Irish Speaking English in the company of sociolinguist Stephen Luketek.
Well, I just love when something that you consider every day has like a cool name. I like these proper explanations. So, and we have all this shaming around mispronunciation. I want to put an end to it by making it fancy. So linguistic terms, let's make it fancy. So let's celebrate our favourites. Stephen, you are our contestant for a rapid-fire linguistics round. So rapid-fire is fast as linguistic gets. So not that. Just take your time. But Paul and Sharon will give you some examples. Maybe you can tell me what the name of this thing is.
We haven't had a hang sandwich since January when I was in hospital after getting a puncture in my lung when I fell off the chimney.
Lots going on there.
Righto. So we'll start with sandwich before we go to ham. Sandwich has, as I did a little sandwich there. You have two sounds right next to each other, d and w. And they're made kind of in the same part of the mouth. And so there's a process called assimilation in linguistics. And that involves making things easier to say. So there's a couple of different ways of doing it. And one of the ways is just by moving that sound back in the mouth a little bit. So it goes hang.
Okay.
So hang as well. We're used to hearing NG sounds at the end of words.
Okay.
So once you're doing one thing with sandwich, you're ready for it before, you know, you're already planning ham. So it's hang sandwich.
Excellent. And yeah. And hostipal.
This is metathesis.
Metathesis.
Wow, I feel giddy.
And metathesis is when you move two sounds around to make a word a little bit easier to say.
And I mean, I feel like if we truly loved our children, we would just make it hostipal anyway, like, because that's what everybody says anyway. So puncture.
Puncture, you're trying to avoid the n-k. So the p is actually a little bit easier to go back.
Okay.
For the k.
And chimley, is that Irish chimelair? No?
Oh, geez. Yeah. I just think it's a sound movement, but there could be a really interesting story there. But a lot of times those stories are a little bit bunk.
Is that us just really wanting everything to be from the Irish language and it turns out there's a more boring explanation?
It's not just us.
So we have assimilation, we have metathesis, we have that thing you said.
Metathesis.
Sharon,
I've already done it.
Sharon, bring us something from the countryside.
The committee want to raise the finance for a new vehicle, so they're going to have a film night.
Okay, so two things going on there. We have emphasis on a different syllable than we're expecting. This, a lot of people will say, goes back to hedge schools, right? Everything goes back to hedge schools. And people were being taught in, you know, a hedge, who the teachers weren't necessarily formally trained. So they may have acquired English in a very, you know, scattershot manner. So when they're teaching English, they're doing some interesting things. So they might have only seen words written down. They might be taking some bits from the Irish language where we have the emphasis usually on the first syllable of a noun. And that just got passed down and down and down.
And phylum?
Yeah, so phylum is not quite metathesis. It's epenthesis.
Oh.
And it's when you have two sounds that you don't really want to have together. Olum. Olum, column. You might be a little familiar yes. with this one.
Yeah. I've always felt parts of me don't go together. One last one. This is from an external source.
You know, I am an optimist, and I do think that, you know, come the second quarter of the year, come April, May, with the better weather, with case numbers down low, with the vaccine provided to a critical mass of the population, we're going to be in a very different place. And, you know, I'm more optimistic about where we're going to be this summer than maybe I should be, but it's impossible to put a date on any particular reopening at this stage. But what I can say to the hospitality sector is that the financial supports that are in place will stay in place.
Is there a special area of political linguistics?
Yeah, usually it involves listening to politicians talk about something without not actually talking about it. They're really talking about nothing. So it's a lot of double talk and obfuscation going down the garden path. Is a fairly common phrase there. I mean, a lot of times a politician is up there and they're asked a question. They're, you know, semi-prepared for it, but they don't really want to give a full answer. And this gets into a bit of the social psychology of, you know, the sorts of language that a politician, for example, would use. But when they're under fire, they do certain things. Now, the actual sounds of the Tánaiste's voice might be related to elocution. A lot of people do elocution courses. It's actually quite a bit on the rise lately. So it sounds to me like he is trying very hard to sound a certain way. And people do that all the time for lots of different reasons, but that's just one of them.
Are we wrong to be snobbish about mispronunciation?
In a word, yes. More likely, there's a process known as language ideology. And that's what happens when We have language attitudes, which everybody has language attitudes. You feel a certain way about a certain way of speaking. People from a certain place, you think, oh, yeah, no, they don't have very good skills in English, which is like, the academic smackdown talk.
From Colm O'Regan, Wants a Word. And in the morning, country superstar Nathan Carter was talking to Marty Morrissey about slowing down with the pandemic and falling in love with Fermanagh.
I fell in love with this county about 7 or 8 years ago. I used to meet my manager, John, who's from Fermanagh, in a hotel called the Killy Hevlin Hotel. I used to see all the boats going past and young fellas up there skiing on jet skis and the whole lot. So I was always into water sports since a kid. My uncle used to have a boat and taught me to water ski when I was very young. So I instantly fell in love with Fermanagh when I seen the lakes and the boats and everything. So I've lived here now for, I think this is 8 years now. This is my 8th year here. And over the years, I wouldn't have had chance because I would have been gigging so much to enjoy the water and enjoy the lovely walks that we've got in countryside and everything. But over the last year, in and out of lockdown, I've enjoyed so much of this county. It's a fantastic place. It really is.
How difficult was it 8 years ago to start living here?
It didn't seem that difficult because for me, music, and especially Irish music, I was brought up involved in traditional music, cultus and competing in flas. And, my mum's side of the family are originally from County Down, a little place called Warren Point near Newry. And so growing up, the music was huge in our house. And that was the reason I came to Ireland, was to do more gigs and more music. And I had a lot of friends here already. So it was just basically like slipping in. And I was that busy for 10 years anyway. I didn't really have a chance to just sit back and look at everything and think, over the last year, I've done more thinking than anything, to be honest. Like most of us, we've just, whenever you stop, you start looking at things and thinking about everything. And in one way, it's great. And I've discovered a lot about myself. In other ways, I've realized how much I've missed the music business and meeting people and just being able to see friends and give them a hug and share a pint with them, go to the pub. And like everyone, it's a funny old time, isn't it?
When you say you go thinking and you've been thinking about yourself, and what have you learned about yourself?
I suppose I've learned that I was probably a workaholic in the fact that I never stopped. And, I never would have been off for this length of time ever. I would never have taken more than 2 or 3 weeks off a year, So I suppose whenever you do have time to sit back and look at things, you reevaluate your life and just what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing, maybe. So, I mean, I've been doing a lot more songwriting and I've been recording a lot more. And, like everyone else, I haven't been able to see my family. My nan would have been on the road with us all the time, who you've met before.
Yes, indeed. Lovely woman,
She would have sold my merchandise at the gigs and Jake's whenever Jake was doing a gig. And, we really miss seeing her. She celebrated her 81st birthday a couple of weeks back. So, stuff like that, you just, I think you take things for granted when you're so busy, and when you have time to look and take time off, you realise that the little things that are very important,
Nathan Carter from the Marty Morrissey Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.